On today's episode, Will and I cover what it really takes to bootstrap your startup from zero. You're probably wondering, how the heck do I get the people I need, market my stuff, and keep the lights on without big money? We walk you through it all, step by step. From how to compensate people without paying them the big bucks, to how you can build your first marketing department and more. You'll find out the strategies that worked for us bootstrapping 10 plus companies to over $1 billion in total revenue. So let's dive into making it happen against the odds. Enjoy the show. Welcome back to another episode of the Startup Therapy Podcast. This is Ryan Rutan, joined as always by Will Schroeder, my friend, the founder and CEO of startups.com. Will, we talk a lot about bootstrapping. The entire startup world is starting to talk a bit more about bootstrapping, which we're really happy about because we do want people to remember that funding is not the only path to success with a startup company. But then it begs the question, how do I actually pay for all this shit if I'm bootstrapping? How does this actually work, right? Cool, I'm not going to go raise money, but how do I pay for things with money I don't have is the lingering question that we're always left with.
You know, I'm tired of not answering it, right? I'm tired of saying, well, everybody bootstraps.
Everybody bootstraps. Everybody does it. Figure it out.
Yep. Yeah, well, it's this weird thing is we just say bootstrapping as if it's this magic pixie dust. But if we just say bootstrapping, you're like, oh, there's that pile of money I didn't know.
Oh, hang on. It's right next to my Amex. It's the bootstrap. There it is. I've got it. I found it. I got my bootstrap.
And it's become this overused, almost like totally amorphous term to mean you don't have money.
Right.
Right? And it's like, how useless is that as feedback? And I say that as a guy who gives that feedback. And I'm tired of giving
time.
That feedback.
Yep.
Right?
We
I'm
do
tired
this
of giving
all
that
the time.
Because I know what it means, you know what it means, but I'm 99% certain the people that we're talking to just look at us going, yeah, great. You solved nothing for me.
Go continue to not have money and not buy things and not
move
forward.
Like,
thanks.
Great. You and your magical bootstrapping. Today, I want to dig into exactly what we mean when we say pay for things without money, right? How do I hire people? How do I be able to do things like launch marketing, which is like one of the first things I'm going to raise money for anyway? How do I pay for all the stuff, right? Because it's cool that I'm, quote, bootstrapping, but what does that actually mean?
Yeah.
So we'll dig in today. We'll talk about those different categories. We'll talk about the actual techniques that folks use, like how it's actually done, what's worked for us, what works for other people. We'll let you know this is what you can do. And specifically, here's what you can't. There's plenty of things. There's plenty of limitations here.
Yeah, because there are a couple of do not flies. Yeah, do not do this. Yep.
Let's set it up just by at a high level, talking about where the challenges are kind of in this space. Now, everybody knows I don't have money, right?
Yep.
Check. Okay. That's clear. But what we're really saying is I know I need like $500,000 to capitalize this business, to pay my salary, to pay for a couple of the people and get shit done. There's nothing you're going to tell me in this podcast that's going to show me how to get $500,000 with, you know, without an investor, et cetera. And you are 100% right. You're not getting $500,000, right? The first thing I want to start off with, that's not how this works, right? Part of what we're implying when we say bootstrapping is trying to figure out how to beg, borrow, steal, which we're going to talk about specifically, for tiny milestones. That's where I want to start things off, right? If you're like, oh, we need $500K to do the whole thing, it doesn't work that way.
Doesn't work that way. Yeah. I think that's the biggest misconception in bootstrapping is that I need $2 million to go build my product, begin marketing, hire a team, and do all this other stuff and have 18 months of runway. And so you say bootstrap, okay, cool. Then I have to bootstrap $2 million. That is not at all. And you just said this, but I'm going to reiterate, that's not what we're talking about. When we go to bootstrap mode, we are talking about getting really nitty gritty with the calculus around what is the next thing I desperately need to just move an inch forward. We're buying our way to the finish line an inch and a dollar at a time, not big tranches of fund. That's called funding, right? This is not funding. I'm going to remind everybody, bootstrap is not funding, right? So we're going to talk about the not funded path here.
You touched on something that's super important in kind of how I wanted to frame this. This is about operating week to week. This is about operating week to week. I don't want to even say hand to mouth, use one of these bizarre euphemisms that doesn't have an actual context to it. We are planning, spending, executing, and returning on a 7-day window.
Yep.
Okay? We're making decisions within 7 days. Why? because that's all we can afford. That's how far we can look out. And if that seems small-minded, if that seems like, well, what a shitty way to run a business, it is later.
Yeah.
It is later, right? If you're 7 years into it and you're still doing that, things haven't gone well. Just honest, okay?
Take the boots off, go home.
Exactly. Where you're at now, in the very formative stages, is you're just learning. You're just trying to figure out how to get from point A to point B as fast as inefficiently as possible. So again, let's go back to the three categories that we'll cover. We'll start with the first one, which is people. Then we'll get into marketing. And then we'll get into what I'm just going to collectively refer to as stuff, just everything else you need. How do we pay for people? Ryan, when you talk to folks and they're like, hey, I need to bring this person on, developer, whatever, what do you tell them?
Yeah. Okay. I think it depends. It depends on, you know, the situation. It depends on what that next milestone is. How far are we from being able to generate cash with that decision? There's a lot of things that go into it. But at the high level, you know, there's a couple ways that we can do this. And I think the two that you and I probably recommend most often are some version of equity or deferred comp, right? This is where we're going to start. Equity, deferred comp, or in some cases, depending on who you are and what you do, there may be some horse trading that can be done. There may be some bartering. I have certainly in the past done work for people and gotten their work in return. They need something I need. We can do a horse trade. Those are the three, right? And actually, in order of preference, it would be the reverse order. I would love to barter time for time so that I can get what I need without parting with equity or without stacking up debt in terms of deferred comp. I would say in terms of ease, deferred comp is often an easier sell because, look, equity is a form of deferred comp anyways.
Yeah, it is.
But it's a form of deferred comp with a much lower likelihood of an actual payout, whereas
absolutely
just promising to pay somebody, then
right,
they assume, rightfully so, that someday you are going to pay.
Right, of course. And here's the way I would look at it. When we say to somebody that it's always, I need to hire a developer, right? And I don't have any money. So I'm going to go raise money, but I can't, the investors won't talk to me. And by the way, that's why they won't talk to you, because you're supposed to have been able to figure this stuff out before you get to them. They don't just give you a magic check and say, okay, now you don't have to worry about anything. It just doesn't work that way, right? Now, again, you also don't know that because you've never gone through this before. So none of this makes sense, which is why we unpack this stuff. So first things first, we need to find this developer. What are we going to say to them? Okay, we find a developer, you know, let's say some random place like Upwork or something like that. And we reach out to them and say, hey, I've got this project. I don't have any cash up front. And I understand cash is king. I get it, right? Not masking that fact. However, here's what I would like to do. I'd like to be able to get to this tiny milestone, not build the whole product, tiny milestone just so I can have something to show either customers, investors, et cetera. And for your time and investment, you'll get X amount of stock, right?
Yep.
Usually a very small amount of stock, a lot if you're doing it all wrong. And you're like, why would anybody agree to that? Yes, and that is how most companies get built.
Yep. Yeah. Yes, it sounds really difficult, and yet somehow it still happens every day, day in, day out. You made a great point here. I want to stick on it for a second, which is that too often what we see is somebody pitch like, and we've told the horror stories around this, around like, you know, you need to get some little feature developed. We need to get an MVP or a proof of concept app out the door, something really basic. And what do they end up doing? Giving away a bunch of equity and bringing on a CTO, who it turns out was just a relatively run-of-the-mill junior developer who's now your CTO. You can see how well that ends, and you gave a bunch of equity to do it. Cool and cool. So I think that there's two things about this. I think that when you make a mountain out of a molehill and you're like, we have all of these crazy things to do, here's what we're building, because we get so used to pitching the vision that we pitch way too much and we make it sound like a lot of work, because it is, but it's all undefined. We don't really know what we're doing long term. We have no idea what we're actually going to end up building at the end. And so we overpitch the workload for what we actually need for right now. For if we're thinking about in terms of a week, we're pitching them 3, 5, 10 years worth of development. And we're like,
right,
what we actually need is a feature by next week. So we oversell it. So then we have to overbuy. So now we have to bring them on as like a full CTO. We have to give up way more equity because you're going to do all this stuff.
Yep.
Whereas if you're just like, hey, I need to release this feature by like, you know, 2 weeks from now. And like, you've got the skill set to do it. What if I kicked you a little equity or some deferred comp? That's a much easier conversation to have. You're much more likely to get a yes, because they're looking at it going, yeah, for them, that'd be really difficult. For me, that's like 3-4 hours worth of work. Cool, right? I don't need to be a partner in your company to do 3 or 4 hours of work. You don't want me as a partner in your company to do 3 or 4 hours of work. So I think it's important to make sure that we're right sizing the ask and the give, and buying what we actually need with the person we need at that time.
That is exactly it, right? So if I only need 2 months worth of work, why am I trying to hire a full-time CTO to quit their job to come work for me, right? Just to your point, hire what you need.
If you need a date to the prom, don't send out marriage proposals.
Yeah, exactly. You're overselling it. Also, if this person can't get past this first milestone of delivering something in 2 months, who cares how committed they are after that? Because they suck.
Yeah, exactly. You'll be really happy they don't have 30% of your cap table at that point.
Right, right. There's this great story by Felix Dennis, who is the founder of Maxim Magazine, The Week, a bunch of bizarre stuff. But he's this crazy guy. That's lived this incredible life. He's passed since then, but he lived this incredible life, and he wrote a bunch of books toward the end of his life. And one of the books he wrote was called How to Get Rich, right? And I love the title. It's so spot on, right? But he's this like quirky Brit, and like he talks about his life in a very bizarre way. When he first started back like in the early 70s, one of the things he wanted to do was create a comic book. He tells the story about how he like went to each person in the production line, the writer, the graphic designers, the printers, everyone, right? The marketers.
Yep.
And what he said was, I found out what was important to each of them, and I sold them that.
Yep, that's exactly
right?
It.
And he said, so I went to the writers, and I said, you know, you'll get your byline on here in a way that you've always wanted. I went to the designers, and I said, you'll be able to create something, draw something that you've wanted to draw. You'll have total license, whereas before you're just like a person with a paintbrush, right? I went to the printer. And I said, I'll pay more than you'll typically get on your rate if you just defer the payment terms, right?
Yeah.
And he's like, and that's how I paid for it. He said that at the time, I had deposited £50 into Lloyd's or wherever he was banking at the time. I think it was Lloyd's. And he said, within 2 years, that turned into 500 million pounds. Or I'm sorry, 60,000 pounds, which I think he said was a $500,000 in today's dollars, right?
Yeah.
And he's like, and I never had a penny. All he did was align what he needed with what other people's interests are. My problem is most people are too lazy to do that. They're too self-centered.
It is. That's the hard part, right? You have to do the investigative journalism. You got to dig in. You got to find out what is going to motivate these people. What do they want to get from this? Because that's what they're thinking on their side. What's in it for me? What's in it for me? Normally, if I work, there's cash in it for me. You have no cash. So what else is in it for me? And I love that story because it's exactly what bootstrapping is about. Bootstrapping isn't this like prescribed particular path around you always pay for developers this way, you always pay for marketing this way, you always do this way. It's about looking at each situation and saying, in order to get to the very next milestone, and I think you put it beautifully, to get to next week, to get to keep playing this game, I have to win this round. How do I win this round? How do I win this hand at the table?
Yep.
And think about all the resources available to you and what is the scrappiest way I can get to that result with what I have, knowing cash isn't one of those things.
Yep.
This is what's constantly happening in bootstrap. It's a crazy, crazy process that I don't know has ever looked exactly the same twice. And we've done this number of time and time again, right? Well, it's how we build our businesses. And it's never looked exactly the same. That underlying principle has always been the same. How do I make sure I'm not asking for anything more than I need at any given time? And I mean this across the board, like it from the, you know, the, my own desires with what I want to have happen with the company. Did I make that next milestone small enough? Did I make it short enough? Right? If you're thinking like, here's what I need to accomplish in the next 3 months, bullshit. Again, break that down. What do I need to accomplish by next week? Because if I don't get to next week, 3 months is a pipe dream, right? Seems like a short amount of time, but not when you have to pass next week to get there. So break things down and don't chase any more than you absolutely need to get to that next level.
I agree. And look, the other side of it too is it's understanding what would equate somebody wanting to take risk, okay? So let's back that up just for a second because it's so important. If we're trying to hire, let's say a person doubles with marketing, right? And we're like, why would they possibly help us with our social media? They're great at doing social media, but why would they possibly help us? Well, let's break it down. Number one, is there some way that they could wind up making more than they'd ever make doing this for what they normally get paid, right? Which is usually the promise of equity. It could be the promise of shared revenue, you know, per this campaign. That's what Felix Dennis did. He said, hey, if this comic sells well, Mr. Printer, you're going to get more than you've ever gotten before, right? That was appealing. The second is there some way this would help you and or your career? How many people do you know that are doing what they want to do, right? Not what they're good at, right? What they want to do. Artists are a great example, right? Every time I've been employed an artist, you know, because we used to own an agency, so we had an awful lot of artists. It was always, they're doing medical journal ads. I guarantee they didn't go to art school for that, right? It sucks. It pays well, really well, right? But it sucks. So you come to them and you say, what would you love to be doing?
Right.
Right. If you had it your way, if you could wake up tomorrow and your job as a creative, your job as a social media marketer would be what you want to do, what would that look like? And by the way, be smart enough to even to ask that question, right? Care about them, it's fundamental empathy, more so than yourself. They will tell you. They're yep. like, dude, I'm stuck doing these lame campaigns. Like, I'm doing social media right now, you know, hypothetically, for real estate companies, right? Not exciting. No. I want to do social media for fashion, right? Yep. You're like, cool, I'm a fashion brand, right? Like, now you get to do it for fashion. I don't think people understand, founders, how few people get to do what they actually want to do. And if you are the opportunity to enable that for somebody, you are God.
You are. And it can come in a lot of forms. I helped somebody sometime, around this time last year, actually, needed, they had great technical founding skills, great leadership skills, had zero understanding of how to market anything, just did not get it, didn't understand it. It was one of those skill sets that was like, I don't understand it. I don't get it. I'm hearing what you're saying. I don't know how to go do that. We need a someone. And so I introduced him to somebody I knew was looking to start doing fractional CMO work because they wanted to be a fractional CMO because they were tired of being a marketing director in the agency that they were in. And they wanted to do something else. So they wanted to upskill that career, but they needed some social proof that they could actually do this. So they took that project on for free, helped them build their go-to-market strategy and their first couple of social media and paid media campaigns. And they got to say, I'm a fractional CMO for this company, right? They've gone on now to pick up other clients. So there's so many of these opportunities. I think I'm just thinking now, Will, just like the delta between when we started doing this, how much easier bootstrapping is now. It's not easy. I'm not saying it's easy. But in terms of being able to find the right fit, right time, right place resources, it's night and day. I mean, you and I were stuck like stomping around the 270 circle trying to find people that had the skills and had the time and wanted the thing, right? It was a lot harder to do unless they wanted Damon's ribs. I happen to have a tab, right? So I think that it's the case now that we can find these situations because we're so much more exposed to so many people and what they want thanks to the old internet.
Yeah, well, the other thing as far as there are lots of ways to pay people, do not forget about a title.
Yeah, yeah.
Right?
Yep. I go to that a 22-year-old... in this case. That's what this person wanted.
I go to a 22-year-old developer and I say, I understand you are line level, like almost intern level developer or wherever you're at now. At my company, you're the CTO, right? Do not underestimate the value of it. And by the way, that does have real value.
It does have real value to that person. It does. Also be very careful because it can have real consequences when all of a sudden a junior developer is your CTO if you get tied into that.
Oh, sure. But I mean, it wasn't everybody an unqualified CTO of like literally every tech company that's ever existed?
Pretty much.
Right. You know what I'm saying? Just like it's kind of the standard fare. But what I'm saying is often when we say CTO, we're referring at CTO at a major company. In other words, the title, right, is usually like we associate it with a major company that it's with. Right. So when somebody says I'm the CTO, they never think to themselves, oh, wait, but I'm a CTO of a two-person company, so I make like $25,000 a year. The value of it to them is I'm a CTO, ergo, I'm point for point with those people in bigger jobs. Not saying I know what they know, but I have the gravitas of that type, right? Same with the CEO. Don't overlook that. You go to a junior-level person, and you say, in my organization, you've got a VP-level title, a C-level title, they will salivate over that. It's all they'll tell their friends about, their parents, everybody. Right? It costs you nothing.
No, but or you don't even have to go that far. If you can level them up to whatever the next career rung is, especially if this, I think depending on whether you want this to be a long-term engagement or short-term engagement, right? If this is something you know is going to be a couple of months and they're going to necessitously move on to something else, because again, like you're not paying them anything. You don't know when you'll be able to pay them. you're paying them with a title that they can leverage into their next job, then, you know, giving them something like a, you know, go from junior to senior developer or senior developer to director, something along those lines. Doesn't have to be the full-on jump. In fact, for their own career progression, might be better, because of course people are gonna look at the resume like, you were a junior developer at an Amazon subsidiary, and now you're a CTO, and now you're applying for a mid-level programmer role, so we're having trouble sorting out. So just even from their perspective, can often be better to just like a couple rungs up. Doesn't cost you as much, doesn't cost them anything.
Just senior in the title.
Yep.
Right? I mean, it can buy you more.
But it is a great conversation starter, right? Like, how'd you like to be a senior developer? I'd love to.
And not overlooked, right? Because you generally don't get the opportunity to just go do that. Just like level up your title arbitrarily. The last piece of this puzzle that I want to talk about is, do not overlook the novelty of new, right? In other words, work on something new and exciting. Most people are working on stuff that they're bored out of their mind with. They hate their jobs. They hate the work that they're doing. They're bored. I meet like so few people, and even think of the industry we're in, where we live and breathe startups, where I meet people that, let's say, aren't the CEO, but even though I apply it there as well, where I'm like, is this the most exciting thing you could be working on, or does it excite you? And the answer is almost always no.
You know, something that's really funny about everything we talk about here is that none of it is new. Everything you're dealing with right now has been done 1,000 times before you, which means the answer already exists, you may just not know it. But that's okay. That's kind of what we're here to do. We talk about this stuff on the show, but we actually solve these problems all day long at groups.startups.com. So if any of this sounds familiar, stop guessing about what to do. Let us just give you the answers to the test and be done with it.
Especially in today's day and age where we need so much stimulation. So just bringing something to the table that is novel and new is compelling as hell to way more people than you think. You know, it's particularly compelling to super senior level people, right? Which is why they always say yes to being an advisor, because they're like, dude, I'm mired in corporate bureaucratic political bullshit all day.
All day.
And now I get to use my brain thinking about something new and fresh and compelling and potentially world-changing? Hell yes.
Yeah, I'm glad you went there. I'm glad you went to advisors specifically. And it doesn't have to be advisor necessarily, but I want to draw a distinction here, particularly around this. There's an intersection here between this, the new and novel, right? I want to work on something that's different than what I'm normally doing, and I can do it fractionally, right? In most cases, we don't need a 40-hour-a-week person. Said differently, we can't afford one anyway, so you'll take what you can get, right? So if you can convince somebody that, hey, it'd be really fun to go work on, like, I'm trying to figure out this new thing using AI prompting to do something else. I'm like, oh, you know, I'm actually super interested in that right now. I'd love to help out. Cool. You want to be our strategic advisor, or do you want to be our whatever, right? You can come up with something that's compelling from a title perspective, compelling from a work output perspective and an optics perspective out to the rest of the world. That also gives you exactly what you need and gives them that creative or whatever outlet it is they're looking for. And we see this happen all the time. It's a great way to get especially really small fractional uses of people's time, which again, often all we need, right?
Let's move on beyond people. Like we've given a lot of examples of that, okay? Let's talk about marketing.
Okay, I like marketing.
I want to start with it with a little parable or story about float, the magic of float. For folks that means nothing to them, it simply means this. Float is what happens between the time that you incur an expense and the time that you pay it. It's called floating the difference, okay? So you guys have all used float because you've all used a credit card at some point, right? And you've paid for something, you've been given goods, and you've then paid for it in actual cash 30 days later whenever you paid off your credit card. That is float. Now, most of the time, we don't think much of the value of that, right? Most of the time, we just think, oh, yeah, it's just convenient, right? When it comes to marketing, float is everything. Float is everything. Let me demonstrate, again, through a parable of how that works. In the 90s, Ryan, when you and I were running agencies, a big part of how things worked, this was kind of pre-float, it was almost the opposite of float, actually. A big part of how things worked was if you wanted to start a company, you paid cash in the barrel head for marketing, generally, and then you hoped you got customers back,
waited for some results. Yep.
Correct. Around the turn of the century, this really interesting thing happened called paid search. What will later become AdWords, which, as you know, folks know, was stolen from Yahoo, and more specifically Overture. What happened, and this was so fascinating to me at the time, was I could buy an ad on Google. When I say it like this, you know I'm kidding, right? I could buy an ad on Google now, charge it to my Amex, and then the Amex bill would come like 30 days later and then give me like a 15-day window to pay. So between the time I incurred the expense, somebody clicked, the time Google charged my card, then Amex ran my 30 days, then I had to pay the bill, I had like 45 to 60 days of flow. Why would anyone care about that?
We talk about marketing too. Float is absolutely an important part of it for paid media. There are also lots of other ways that we can fund our marketing, performance marketing being a major one of those, where there's going to be some share in the proceeds, right? Plenty of shops out there that will do that. Plenty of individuals you can do that with. You know, you can do things on just a cost per acquisition basis, a cost per sale basis,
deals,
a revenue share. There's all sorts of mechanisms that we can use within marketing, right? Go to somebody that has an email list, that has an audience, that wants what you have, and test that, right? And
yep,
then you just, they get paid when you get paid. Will everybody say yes to that? No. Is any of this easy? No. So just go do the work, you know, put your shoes on, start stomping around, go find the people who will say yes to these things. But there are tons and tons of ways of doing this, from, you know, affiliate sales to, you know, full-on partnerships to list swaps to you name it. There are ways to get these things done with very little or no cash that also don't require. Because, of course, the other way with bootstrap marketing is the founder or, you know, the founding team is just doing it all themselves. We're like, well, we're just going to write scads of organic content and then wait a couple of years for it to rank. And yeah, you can do that. But there are also ways with zero cash that you can go out and begin to generate real revenue, which I'm a huge fan of, because if we want to go raise money to find out that advertising is not going to work, why would we want to do that? Like, why would we want to go give up equity in our company to get cash to find out it's not going to work? But if we can find out it's not going to work in a very short period of time, we'll find out that it does and then eliminate the need for funding. Which one of those paths sounds better to you?
Think about all the different ways people have done this successfully. Kickstarter was built on this. Kickstarter was built like, let's market it now. In this case, they had a platform to help people do it for free. But a lot of that, you know, wasn't on just Kickstarter. It was through social media campaigns. It was, you know, through a lot of other mechanisms. But same concept. Let's collect money now and let's pay for it later. I mentioned briefly that terms is, you know what it's historically been called with your vendors.
Sure.
And your vendors say, we're willing to give you a window between when we give you the product and when you have to pay for it. I'll give you two examples. When I gave you the Felix Dennis example, he was the founder of Maxim Magazine, The Week Magazine, et cetera. When he was starting that comic book, I mentioned he went to his printer and he said, I'll pay you more, but I need you to give me terms. In other words, I need you to tell me you'll print the damn comic book now, but you won't charge me for printing it for 90 days. That is the flow. Right? And it's a magical form of capitalization.
We all learned this in Popeye, man. Wembley will gladly pay you Tuesday for a hamburger today. Right? I'm not sure he ever paid up on this, but...
Yeah, well, that's the other... also gonna pay. The second one I always thought was fascinating, although I don't know if it was a strategy or if it was just an outcome. My old business partner that you remember, Blaine, we did Blue Diesel, the first the agency with, his dad started Cardinal Health, which, for those that are unfamiliar, and most people would be, it's like a $100 billion company. And one of the things that Cardinal did extremely well, which I always thought was hilarious, was not pay people. Now, I say that Bob Walter, his dad, would probably kill me if you heard me say this. But I just thought the strategy was brilliant. Hear me out. Where he basically just said, look, we will hit certain levels of scale where people have to do business with us. So they'll get paid when we get paid. Now, one of the things people always used to think was that the reason we did so well in healthcare back in the day was because Blaine's dad was, you know, essentially a billionaire and started this big company. And the little known fact that I always thought this was hilarious, those fuckers never paid us. True to their word, we never got paid from those guys. They would owe us money for the longest time, and I was always amazed at their resilience. They're like, look, we're huge. If you want to keep doing business with us, we'll pay you when we pay you.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, yeah.
They were essentially making us finance them.
Right.
Which is how they became a multi-billion dollar company.
That's
even
it.
At that stage.
That's it. That's it. It's float of a different sort, but it's float nonetheless.
Yep. And to them, it was worth billions of dollars to put people off, right? Yes, it strains relationships, but it also builds billion-dollar companies. You know, the float within marketing, you know, kind of bring this back. What we're really saying is, what can we implement so that we can get paid now, vis-a-vis bring people in the door to collect some cash, so then we can pay it back later, okay? The notion, the default notion for people to understand this, which is most people, would be, no. Like, I have to have a lot of money in the bank, and I have to be able to buy marketing and maybe hope it'll work, but I have to pay for it, right? And when I say have to pay for it upfront, I would stack rank, as anybody should, all of the different ways I can market and say, what can I do for free now? Newsletters, email, social, you know, some level of SEO that's, like you said, deferred. And, you know, what kind of efforts required? I would then say, what are all the paid ways that I can instantly drive traffic or sales that I could find a way to pay for later post-sale? I don't think people understand, like, that's how you build a business.
One of the more interesting tactics I've seen for this recently is this this notion of, like, the add-on sale, right? So there's something I can tack on. You know, you also want to add this to your cart, right? And I'm using cart really broadly here. This doesn't necessarily have to be a physical product. Could be digital, could be anything. But basically, you decided to buy something. Actually, let's use an information product. You bought an information product. And then there'll be this additional, hey, for only $99 today, you can have this other thing. That is actually a really interesting way. So you go out and find somebody that's selling something that's fully complementary to what you're selling, and then say, hey, you want to tack me on as a post-sell, upsell, and I'll give you half the revenue, whatever you can afford to give them.
Yeah, huge cut, because you're going to get zero otherwise.
Right, and you have zero acquisition costs because they're going to promote this thing for you. So they're running paid ads, they're driving people into a funnel, they're converting people, and now you get to benefit from some of their conversions, and yeah, they get to keep some of the proceeds. But again, if like this is a digital product, your margins are 100%, so you can afford to give away 99%, still make a dollar, right? So kind of doesn't matter at that point.
I always hear people complain about how like Amazon or eBay extracts, you know, or Etsy takes too much of a price. And I'm like, easy solve, man. Take exactly what you're paying them and go do the marketing and get customers at a lower rate of acquisition than they do, and you're good. They're like, well, yeah, well, I can't do that. Then, dude, you're getting a discount every time.
That's it. Yeah, we actually, this came up yesterday in our Getting Customers workshop where somebody was talking about wanting to expand beyond Amazon. And I said, right, have you pushed Amazon for all it's worth? And have you tested what it will take to acquire those customers?
Yeah.
There were all these other soft, well, you know, but there's also the benefit of I can have direct communication, I can do this. I said, okay, to what end? What do you want them to do? Now you've got direct communication. What do you want them to do? Buy more stuff. Can you get them to buy more from Amazon? Yeah, then do that. Like, and of course, I'm oversimplifying it.
Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, we had a much deeper conversation. But at the end, that's what we came back to. It was like, okay, we're not done with this model yet. And this is actually pretty damn beneficial to us. Turns out when people go out and acquire all your customers for you, you will, and you should pay for that. And,
yeah, imagine
and if you
that.
Don't, you'll pay more for it to do it yourself.
Okay, let's move on to stuff. Okay, so we've covered people. We've covered marketing. Let's cover stuff. How the hell do I pay for everything else? Okay, and that is everything from office space, which people don't have as much of an issue with anymore, to like just the basic supplies, your SaaS costs of just running a business, et cetera.
Yeah, first thing that came to mind for me was SaaS costs. It's like that is the office furniture of 2024.
It is. I agree with that. Here's how it works. The short answer is you use credit cards.
Yeah.
And everyone's like, okay, yeah, great. Didn't know that. Okay. The longer answer is when and how do you use credit cards? In other words, what's the right spend? What's the wrong spend? Okay. Because if you understand how to use, like, how to use credit cards, they actually make a ton of sense. And you almost can't believe, like, you're able to get away with it. If you're spending it on the wrong things, you're like, this is idiotic. Like, my bills are just getting astronomical. Like, what's happening? Because there's a wrong and right way to do it, okay? Both of them cost you money, but one of them you can never get out of, okay? Let's start with the wrong way. I think that's a little more important, right? The wrong way are on almost always categorically these things. People, if you are paying salaries, now I understand that you kind of sort of can't pay salaries directly off a credit card, right? You know, as far as kind of the mechanisms, I'm well aware of how to extract that value.
cash advances. There are ways to do it, and they're all bad.
Just generally speaking, if you're paying for people on a credit card where you can't directly get that money back, it's a bad idea. Examples. Ryan, if back in the day you and I are running our agency, that's just a cost of goods sold. If I'm paying a designer up front because I'm then going to go back to the client and charge for that and get paid back, that's actually just flow all over again. I'm paying up front, I'll pay later for my credit card, and that's kind of how I'll get my money back. People do it all the time, right? It's generally a pretty good use because you're paying for product that you are directly selling.
It's inventory with a different name.
Inventory, exactly it. Here's where people take that the wrong direction. I'm like, well, how is that any different than paying a developer to build my MVP of my product so that I can go out and sell my product and then get paid back, right? Because you have no idea that you're going to get paid back.
Time frame would be one of those. Yeah. Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Now that, again, you could make the argument to say, the uncertainty exists in inventory too. If I buy 30,000 t-shirts and nobody buys the t-shirts, aren't I in the same? Yes, you are, just to be clear, right?
No, think of the money you'll save on laundry for the next 15 years.
But more specifically in this case, we're saying don't pay for essentially non-recoverable expenses. Rent. It's a non-recoverable expense. You pay for that. You'll never see that money back, right? Anything where you keep telling yourself it's an investment, but you can't figure out how to get that money back within the next 30 to 60 days is a bad use of credit.
Anything that doesn't have an obvious ROI, a known ROI, right? There will be times where we have to float some stuff like marketing where we may not know it's going to work, but we're also going to be able to limit the period of time in which we don't know that, either we know that it works and we're going to be able to cover that cost, or we know that it doesn't work and we're not, and then we can stop.
For things where, like, again, if I'm buying inventory and I know that I can recover because I'm going to sell the t-shirt and get my money back, I'm good. If I use credit, and I can't sell the thing to get my money back directly, it's generally, categorically, probably a bad idea. And I've done it, and I've regretted the hell out of it. Early in the day, like, I used to, like, you know, basically indirectly pay for developers or whatever on credit cards, and it was awful. It never paid back, right? Because a lot of those things are just hardcore expenses that you need a different, kind of more efficient mechanism to pay for, like equity. Like deferred comp, like some other thing that isn't cash on the barrel headed on a high interest credit card. It just doesn't work.
How do you slot something like SaaS into this, right? So if you're using, let's do a comparison of, like, you got Slack in there, you've got HubSpot in there, you've got Freshdesk or Zendesk or somebody, like, you got some customer service. How do you factor those in?
Here's how I factor them in. Number one, again, and I don't want to be callous in saying this, I don't use them until there's absolutely no other way to do it. And everyone's like, well, but I really need that.
You use the free version. You use the duct tape and bubble gum version.
Use the goddamn spreadsheet.
Google spreadsheet. Yep,
yeah,
exactly.
Right? Like, anybody that says it can't be done without X, I'm like, you know what? A million people have done it without it.
Anybody who says it can't be done without X was born after 2000. Let's just be honest.
Well done.
Because we all know that it can be done because we used to do it for a long time without any of that shit.
That's what I'm saying.
Still do it without any of that shit.
Like, time and time again, people say it can't be done without whatever. One, because they haven't tried, or two, just because they just don't know. That, you know, they've never seen a world where you couldn't do it that way. I'll take accounting, for example. Most reasonable people are going to be like, no, you need an accounting package. Like, that's why QuickBooks exists. Ryan, we've been running for 12 years. And we have no QuickBooks, right?
No
Our
QuickBooks.
Whole company's run off a friggin' spreadsheet that costs $0, right?
Zero.
And it's efficient as hell, right?
Yep.
I don't think people are willing to question that there's another way to get something done, right? Again, a lot of it comes from lack of experience. If you're coming into this for the first time and you don't understand the tool set that's out there or the options, then very naturally you're going to say, well, I guess you're supposed to use HubSpot because that's what people said. Use HubSpot last. Once you've figured everything else out, then you eventually migrate to the gold standard, right? That would be like saying, hey, I want to learn to drive. I need to start with a Bentley.
Yeah, I mean, clearly.
Not,
safety
might
first.
Might not be the way to start. I think part of it, too, is taking a look at everything that we need now operationally and saying, yes, we need this later. What is the scrappy, not as efficient way to do it that actually gets this moving forward?
That old analog I keep using. It's aim for the moon, clear the fence, right? What are we going to do today to clear the fence? We don't need the dream house. We need a tent on the land. We need the most basic version that gets us to the point where we can accomplish the task at hand and nothing more, right? Like when you have 8 expenses and $0 in your bank, why do you need an accounting package exactly? Right? Like, what are we accounting for? Yep, we're still poor. Ran the report again.
Let's use Slack because I think it's a great example. I love Slack. Honestly, I think it's maybe one of the best pieces of software ever written. And I know that's a strong statement. And it's not because I'm a fanboy by any means, because we live off of it. Like, I don't know how you could build a more effective piece of software that doesn't involve living off. With that said, to this day, we don't pay for Slack. I'm nervous even putting that in the universe, right? But a lot of people don't pay for it.
Slack's coming for us.
If we did pay for it, it would give us things like more history. And we've had folks in the organization come to us and say, hey, we need to pay for Slack because we need more history. And I'm like, no, we don't. Copy whatever you need. Save it somewhere else. Problem solved, right? I'm not paying $25,000 for something.
Drop it into a GDoc. Drop it into a Notion. Drop it into one of the other 50 million tools that exist to do things like record information.
And we can afford it, right? Like, we can afford Slack. And we're like, yeah, not going to happen. We can afford a more complex accounting system. And we're like, yeah, not going to happen, right? Because we've grown up with this discipline that because it exists doesn't mean I have to have it, which I think is powerful.
And it's so tricky because I think the narratives out there are that this is what everybody's using. This is the way you do this. Here's your MarTech stack. You don't think about anything else. This is what you need. This is what you have to have. And it's a dangerous mentality. It's the same challenge that you and I fight all the time around everybody thinking that they have to be a funded startup company. I have to have all of these tools so that I look like a startup company because this is what everybody else uses. One, no, you don't. Two, no, they don't. You don't have to use it. And most of them don't. I think this is the story that gets told. But yeah, especially at the bootstrap stage, we have to just be scrappy, right? We're the MacGyvers of the startup world at this point. It's duct tape, it's bubble gum, it's a candy wrapper, it's whatever, right? We just have to get the job done. Whatever tool we have, we're going to have to use, right?
Well, yeah, and it's also being able to say, is it necessary now? Not would it be nice to have, is it necessary? I got to be honest, you've been at this for 30 years. There's not much that's necessary. There is just not.
Not absolutely necessary.
If we go back game show style, right? Reality television style. And you say, Man in the Wild, Ryan and Will, right? You have $500 of which to start building a company. Go, right? And forget like personal expenses for a second.
I was like, man, there went 150 to ramen noodles.
but what I'm saying is like, we would look at that and we would stack rank all of our opportunities and say, what can we afford? What can we defer? And what I'm trying to say is, show me a startup that's like, I need all this money, and I'll show you a startup that has not gone through this process, right?
Yeah, of course. No, they're just they build the ideal world scenario.
Yep.
Here's the hint, folks. You don't build startups in an ideal world. It's about the furthest thing from that. Right? You are Tom Hanks in Castaway, right? You are going to make friends out of volleyballs. You're going to eat whatever you can catch, right? This is what it looks like.
Yeah, I agree. But what I'm saying, going back to stuff, right? And I'm trying to do some hard first cuts. Number one, there is very little that you need to run most businesses. Need, want, yes, need very little. Having been through this for a very long time, I can say that with certainty. Number two, for the stuff that you absolutely need, like there is no way you can move from week one to week two without it, put it on a credit card. Hey, where does the money come from? Dude, it comes from a credit card. There is no other magic thing you don't know about. There's not the payday advance of startups, right? Like, it's a fucking credit card, right? It's your home equity line. It's your savings account. Now, most people are like, yeah, no shit, I already knew I had those. Yeah, because that's how you pay for them. I guess sometimes it helps to know that there actually isn't another answer. And I'm telling you, for all the little stuff,
I think that's it. I think that's the most powerful thing, is like that this is what it comes down to. Right? Do you want to do this or not? You don't have to play this game. You can go home. But if you want to play this game, it's going to mean pushing your chips onto the table, right? This is what it takes. You're going to have to put some of your personal capital at risk. You're going to have to put your credit score and you know, your personal payments history at risk, right? This stuff happens. But to your point, trim it down, think about exactly what we need and what we don't need. And when we say need, right, like we're talking things like, you know, if you want to have a website, you have to host it somewhere, right? You can't just be like, well, I'll just, you know, host it in my hands. I'll just hold it. No, you got to pay for that, right? You got to have a payment processor, right? We don't want you trying to do that. Like, okay, just mail your cash and checks to, right? Probably not the right way to do it. You could do that. You absolutely could do that. Would it slow down? But again, you can get a payment processor for free, right? You can get these things, right? You'll pay for them, but in different ways.
All the things that you're paying for monthly, my first question is always, do they deliver value monthly, right? I'll give you a simple example. Netflix does not deliver value monthly. And people are like, oh, bullshit. You know, I use it all the time. Okay, cool. But Netflix delivered most, like take any streaming services. They'll deliver most of their value based on back catalog, right? For the first few months to a year. But once you burn through most of the stuff that is interesting to you, the ongoing value each month thereafter can be zero. We subscribe to like 5 streaming services. So we're like on Max, on Hulu, whatever. And every month I look at them just because I'm a founder and I say, what is the ROI of Disney compared to what it was a year ago when my kids had back catalogs to dig into? Now back catalog's exhausted. All they have to deliver now, and I'm just using this as an example, is like one shitty show a month, right? So now we're paying the same price for essentially one shitty show a month. We'd be better turning it off, waiting a year, and paying for it then. There's something back catalog. I say this because most SaaS and services work the same way, right? Most SaaS is like, it was really valuable in the first few months we needed it. Most vendors were very valuable in the first few months when we needed them, but that value drops off exponentially at some point, yet we keep thinking in terms of paying them on a perennial basis, right? That kind of discipline is what we're talking about when we're talking about startups.
There's an interesting trap that just came to mind. And this is one of those where I think people get tricked into or convinced to pay for things before they need them. And it's this notion that, well, if you don't build it right now, or if you don't start with the right infrastructure now, it'll be a lot harder to switch later. Number one, 99 times out of 100, that's just bullshit. It's not any harder to switch later. There's a little bit of extra work there, sure. But you know what's a lot harder? Not being able to buy the other thing that you really needed because you spent money on something you didn't need now to save yourself some work in a future you don't even know exists yet, because you might not make it that far because you spent money on the wrong shit today. So it's one of those things that I hear founders say this all the time. Like, no, we decided to, you know, do, you know, the full backend stack. We're gonna do it right. Neat. How's that going to help you make money tomorrow? How's that going to help guarantee that you're around next week, the week after, the week after? And the answer is always, well, it doesn't. It'll just make life easier in the future. Sorry, but fuck your future. We need to worry about right now if you're going to have a future. Your future is inconsequential if today doesn't work, if tomorrow doesn't work, right? A month out is completely irrelevant.
I hate the axiom, you have to spend money to make money. I hate when people say that, because they use it as a blanket excuse to spend money, right? As if spending money is a challenge.
Yeah, to convince people to spend money they don't have in most cases, right? Like that's where you see this come out the most.
We use the opposite. We use something called, you have to make money to spend money.
Yes.
Right?
That's actually, by the way, that's where the concept came from, right? Like,
right,
you had to give something of value to get money so that you could give money to get something of value. This is the core concept of money. It was,
yep,
value for value exchange, and somehow we forgot that. I need to go get money so I can buy things. No, you need to make money so you can go buy things.
Let's go back to our faux reality show for a second.
Sure.
Right? We've got $500, right? And we sit down and we say, we have to make money to spend money. What do we mean? Okay. In the next episode, Ryan and Will are bartenders.
Yes.
Because they're trying to make money so they can generate some capital so they can go spend it on their business,
yep,
right? Make money to spend money means we need to do whatever the hell we need to do now so that we can have some cash to,
yep,
to make investments with.
We talked about this a couple episodes ago, and I think it was a great discourse. Because I think that so many people feel like once they start the startup, it has to stay on this like really fine and narrow path that just points toward that product or whatever, as opposed to saying like, hey, I could trade my services to get this thing I need. Hey, I could sell services just to get cash to buy something I need. And it too often goes by the wayside, and we think that, like, look, it's either raise $2 million or go home. That is one way of doing it.
It's good to ensure the answer is go home. If you and I were starting a taco stand, okay, and it turned out that the fat was that, yeah, we're bartenders by night, we're selling tacos during the day. But if it turned out that we were like, dude, for the time being, we can make more money selling delivering pizzas as well as selling tacos, then guess what? You and I are delivering pizzas.
We are delivering pizzas. Yeah, yep, that's exactly it.
Whatever it takes, we have to make money to spend money.
This
right?
is bootstrap, folks. This is what it looks like.
That's what we're talking about, right? It's not what people think, which is I have this bolus of cash and I deploy it in such a clever way that it makes me more money. That sounds right. awesome. That Does. Sounds awesome, right? Yep. Number one, it rarely works. And number two, that's usually not a situation you're going to be in, right? When we do these episodes, we're doing these episodes to break down all these bullshit myths so that you have something actionable that you can actually go do something with. If we sat here in Gary Vee, and this isn't even a disrespect to Gary Vee, but if we just said, oh, just crush it, you know, to me, that's this same amorphous bullshit, right? Or, oh, just raise lots of money. Yeah, not really, right? Like, that sounds cool, but it usually doesn't wind up where you think it does. And by the way, it's also not going to happen to you, right? So to me, that's useless advice.
It is. Now, I like the point. There's so many of these little traps out there, right? Like, you gotta spend money to make money. Actually, you know what you have to do to make money, Will? You have to make money. You have to make money to make money. That's actually just like, it's that simple, right?
However you have to make it, right? However you have to make it. Going back to the story at the top of the episode, we were talking about Felix Dennis. He was like, I had so many side hustles on how I made money to actually fund my real business and what I was trying to do, that at the time, it would, if you snapshotted my life at that moment when I was starting whatever business I was starting, it wouldn't even look like I was starting that business. Why? Because he was busy making money so that he could spend the money again to go make money, which I know a fact we're hammering home pretty hard, but it's fairly important. So here's what I would say. If we zoom out and we say, what's this bootstrapping thing all about,
yep.
right? This bootstrapping thing is all about saying, how do I understand, number one, what I need? How do I understand, number two, the least that I need? And what are all the most efficient ways to go about acquiring that thing that ideally requires either no money or requires me paying money sometime in the future when I have some money? But if anybody's, you know, listening to this going, hey, all that sounds hard. Yeah, it's really hard. If you're listening to this saying, yeah, it would be easier to raise money. Of course it would. And by the way, you're probably not going to. And that's perfectly okay. What we're talking about is being disciplined about looking for all the opportunities to maximize money that you wouldn't have otherwise had. And silver lining to all of this, if you apply these same processes and mentality now, this will make you a way more efficient company if you decide to get capitalized or not.
Overthinking your startup because you're going it alone? You don't have to, and honestly, you shouldn't, because instead, you can learn directly from peers who've been in your shoes. Connect with bootstrapped founders and the advisors helping them win in the Startups.com community. Check out the Startups.com community at www.startups.com to see if it's for you. Could be just the thing you need. I hope to see you inside.